survival from a point of view that is very in league with what we're doing here in terms of science. Tom Bearden, are you still with us?
I'm still here, Bill.
All right. Let's get back to our science. Let's get back to these free energy devices, which will render the need for war useless.
Well, you know, unless, Bill, we can do something for essentially everybody that's in the world, and I'm talking about even in the darkest regions of any corner of the earth, the poorest people, in the areas where, you know, peasants live, or where very primitive tribes still exist. Unless we can raise the standard of living and the conditions of living of everybody, health and so forth, we're going to continue to have an awful lot of man's inhumanity to his fellow person, or the worst case, you know, wars. We're going to have wars and wars and wars. But if we can do something that can make everybody's life a lot better, a lot easier, can take some light into those dark corners, and just not have to take a whole lot of fuel and keep pumping it in there because they don't have the money to buy it, then I think we can do something for everybody. And I think cheap energy, the source is free. We'll have to pay a little bit to build the device to tap it. You have to buy a paddle wheel to go in the river.
Right.
But if we can provide cheap, clean, easily portable and easily usable energy, flexible, then I think all of that can be changed. And I think we've got to do something like that. Otherwise, we're going to have nothing but nations and groups of people set against other nations and other groups of people.
I have
and
a letter here, Tom.
We use science to destroy ourselves, not to lift ourselves out of the mud.
To go with what you're talking about, I have a letter here from Prince Polami of Nigeria. And he is talking about the plight of the people of Nigeria. That those people in that country spend 70% of their wealth buying energy sources to just support the very, very primitive society that they have in Nigeria, which, of course, drains the resources of all of the people just to have electricity, because they have no great sources of their own there, which keeps them backwards, which keeps their villages without electricity, quite often without the food that they need. They cannot develop their culture. They cannot develop the raw materials that they have within that country to develop a national thing of their own, because they cannot afford the energy. And what we're looking at here in very rudimentary forms are things that they can have in each one of those little villages in Nigeria and develop their own economy, develop their own supply of goods and services, not only for themselves, but to export throughout the world. But the way they are now, and the way the most of the world is now, they are of the have-nots. And because they cannot afford the energy, they will always be the have-nots. And whenever you have a world filled with haves and have-nots, you have a world that's filled with tensions and that is on a brink of war.
Well, you also have a world filled with people who, because of poverty, a lack of communication and so forth, are very easily misled, very easily gathered into large groups dominated by tyranny. And such groups then can be set against other groups, and that gives you war. If we can do something to eliminate the roots on which war feeds, then we can certainly lessen the stigma of the thing that really ravages mankind and takes the best people we have. Today, war is not a kind of a war that people used to think about, historically have thought about, that the soldiers in the field fought the war, and there was very little damage to the populations, really, of the countries. And so a country could lose a war, be taken over by another country, and it really wasn't a great disaster. And that's not what we have today. What we have today is the threat of near total annihilation, certainly of great nations and maybe of most of the population of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So we find ourselves in a real quandary. On the other hand, just simply spouting off that if we would lay down our weapons, we wouldn't have war, that won't get it. Unilateral disarmament won't get it. We've got to have something that changes the fundamental problems of man all across the world. We've got to have that. I think free energy or very cheap energy will be one thing that does it. I'd like to add one point. We waste, in this country, we throw away our most precious resource. We discard it as if it did not even exist. And I'm talking about those rare people who have the creative genius to discover new principles of nature and new devices. I'm talking specifically about people that you can start all the way back with Nikola Tesla. You can come up to T. Henry Moray. I'd include the Rogers system. And I would include a lot of other modern-day people, and I would specifically include John Bedini, Jim Watson, Frank Golden, and Howard Johnson.
We might even throw Joe Newman in there.
And Joe Newman, certainly. He does have a machine which does work, and he deserves a patent for it. Now, what we do is we put or try to put these kinds of native creative geniuses in a bottle, in a box, tie a weight around their feet and throw them in the river to drown. That's what we'd like to do. When in fact, the spark that runs our country and makes everything better has come from the inventor. And most of those have not been the corporate inventor. They have been the lone tinkerers. They are the people who have this native genius of discovery. And that's a gift. You're born with it or you don't have it. It's not something you can teach in school. It's almost like dowsing. The individual that has that gift can sit down and start doing experiments. He will discover effects that you can sit in a laboratory in a university environment and try to do experiments for 10 years and never run across. And he'll run across them the first or second time he does it. Mm-hmm. It's just a native gift. Now, what we should do is instead of spending vast sums of money on things like Synfuel corporations and so forth, we should have a system whereby the lone inventor, the creative genius, has some kind of funding set up for his experiments and his tinkering. And we should have other people who take them, things that he finds out, and go into development with it. Because development is a separate problem. And then take care of the inventor. If you did that, a lot of the things that we think are barriers would change very quickly. Well, they buried Tesla very early on for the very idea that he was going to give the world real cheap energy. And that was the last thing they wanted to do.
We can thank J.P. Morgan for that. I don't mind pointing a finger at him. History is quite adamant in its condemnation of J.P. Morgan. And what he did to Nikola Tesla, he denied us free energy.
But he also gave you the Spanish-American War.
He
engineered that little fiasco.
I think that it wouldn't take too much to say that he gave us World War I.
A great deal of it, that's right.
And he gave us great economic disasters because of greed. And I'm looking at a young man whose life has been threatened because he wants to give you free energy right now, and that's John Bedini. And those things, of course, make me extremely angry. What we want to do, Tom, we're going to have to take a break here right now. Take a little pause for the news. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Hour 2 of Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's KABC. And we're talking about your future. A whole new, bright, and brilliant future if it's allowed to develop and flourish. And I think it can. And with me in the studio are two of the men that are terribly responsible for it, Mr. John C. Bedini and Mr. Stephen Wirth, and on the telephone, speaking to us from Dallas, Texas, is Thomas E. Bearden. Tom has electrified, if I can use that term, this audience for many, many years. And as we talked, John Bedini came into being. Tom, you remember that?
Yeah, I sure do. certainly do.
John is amongst us. He has done some things. We're looking at things in this studio right now that would that most people that are in electronics would say are impossible, that they cannot happen. Certainly, he has just fractured the second law of thermodynamics and the law of conservation of energy with not only these two devices, but the other ones that are over there. We call it his laboratory. Well, you've seen it and I've seen it. It's too bad he doesn't have a real laboratory to work in. But what the science is here, that we can tap this river of energy that you talk about, and it can be put to work, and it can be put to work in our homes, and it can be put to work in our industries, it can be put to work everywhere on the earth, on the world. We don't have to burn oil anymore. We don't have to build great dams anymore. We don't have to expend vast amounts of our wealth for energy. Most people don't seem to realize that their energy cost is the greatest single cost they have. Every bite of food that they eat, they pay an energy cost for. Every stitch of clothing they wear, they pay an energy cost for. Every good and service that they consume, they pay an energy cost for. And whenever you start adding all of that up on top of your electric bill and your gasoline bill, those obvious energy costs, it turns out to be a greater cost than taxes, if you can imagine that. I shouldn't say that because that'll give the IRS an idea to run forward and try to get more money than your energy costs are. Hello?
Hello. I'm still here. I was thinking about the things you were saying, and I guess one of the things that I did want to point out was that every time in science that there's been a fundamental change that occurred, there has been extreme resistance to that change. We long since have forgotten it, of course, but when Einstein brought out relativity, it was caused a furor. The conventional physicists at one time, you know, were prone to make statements like, there's only a dozen people in the world can understand it. Many physicists never accepted it to their dying day. But the young graduate students who had not yet been brainwashed didn't have that big a problem in understanding it. So when more and more of those young graduate students came out, all of a sudden relativity was an accepted term, an applied term. The thing has happened with many other things. Ironically, the fellow who really discovered conservation of energy, or mostly Meyer, was hounded literally by the scientists of his day into the insane asylum. Finally got out of there with treatment and so forth. But in his later life, he was then eulogized as a great man when he'd been called an utter fool. The great Gauss, for example, worked out nonlinear geometry and didn't dare publish it for over 30 years. He wouldn't publish it because he knew it would destroy him if he did, that his fellow scientists would destroy him.
But now they revere him.
And a brash young man published it, and they destroyed him. So science has a record. Anybody who knows anything at all about the history of science, it has a record, its own record right now, with opposing bitterly every fundamental new change that's come out.
Well, I think most everybody is familiar with the story of Madame Curie.
Certainly. The lady here recently, suddenly her name escapes me, that, you know, with the corn, with genes and so forth, that could change. And that was utter nonsense. And then all of a sudden she winds up getting a Nobel Prize some decades later. But every single thing that's been a drastic change has been done that way and been opposed in that fashion. The great Planck himself, Max Planck, once said that, you know, the only way you get a new physics is when the old physicists die off that so bitterly oppose it and stop it. And I think the real thing that the experimenters like John Bedini and so forth have done is to point a very strong finger at unique effects and results that are to be gained by making deliberately electromagnetic stressed zeros. And I think the thing to do is to say, look, these kinds of effects have not been investigated by the universities. Don't you think it's about time that the universities themselves started doing the investigation? I've reached this point. If someone calls me and starts objecting to these kinds of ideas on principles in the present textbook, my first question to them is this. Have you ever done a set of experiments in this area where you made such stressed electromagnetic zeros and examined the behavior of materials and circuits and so forth with those electromagnetic entities? If the answer to that is no, I have not done such experiments and made such a great investigation, then my next response to them is, don't bother me until you have. You don't know what you're talking about. Because what happens is the people like John Bedini are doing that. And a whole host of other young fellows right now who are beginning to do these kinds of experiments. And the thing we really are trying to do, and John is trying to do, is to try to point out to these young fellows, don't believe these self-imposed limitations and assumptions. You can change those assumptions. And in this area, if your textbook doesn't tell you what happens when you make this kind of thing, go do your own experiments and find out. Do it by the scientific method. Don't believe dogma.
These laws were not fingered by God on tablets of stone on Mount Sinai.
That's correct. If as long as you do not change the assumptions on which those laws are based, you're going to get those laws. They are very good laws, very good descriptions. So if you change some of the fundamental assumptions, and here we're changing one of them, because all of those conservation laws assume you do not have stress zeros like that, where energy is locked into vacuum and deliberately varied by patterns, deterministic patterns. If you have not investigated those kinds of experiments, you have nothing scientifically to reject it out of hand with. So at least reserve the judgment until you've done experiments. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the new energy developments that John and Steve have done.
Well, I appreciate your comments there, Tom. I just wanted to add one thing. A friend of yours and mine was a guest on this, Dr. Ruggiero Santelli. And he pointed out a very, very important fact, I think, concerning the universities when they get into this kind of experimentation. And certainly we have great citadels of learning here in Southern California, and a lot of those people listen to this radio program. And we have great aerospace industries that are deeply involved in science. But if they were to start getting into these experiments, they have all once rendered their textbooks useless. They have kissed off great grants, goodbye, and contracts, goodbye, based upon an old science. And they do not want to upset the economic apple cart or their egomaniac apple cart, because they are now the great gurus of science. We do have that problem of ego to deal with, don't we?
Yes, we do, and I can't resist giving one quote. This quote is from the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology, you know, standard whole shelf of reference books all in one great encyclopedia. Very well done set of books, by the way. When you add all this stuff up we're talking about in physics, in the ordinary physics, you get invariance that's behind all the conservation laws, or they go hand in hand together. If you do what we're talking about, you break the idea of invariance. If you oscillate space-time, the curvature of space-time, you do not have to have invariance from one time or one place to another. And let me give you the quote. Without such invariance, laws of nature would change with the passage of time. They were talking about the time invariance. And repeating an experiment would have no clear-cut meaning. In fact, science, as it is known today, would not exist. So what we're saying is, the restrictions that are placed on the science today, the conservation laws and invariance, can be changed. That's what we're stating. We're stating how you can change it, in principle, in detail. And we are pleading with the university graduate students, and with the professors too, if they would like to, please do some experiments in this area and see for yourself. Use the scientific method. But if you've not done any experiments, it is not scientific to immediately reject it out of hand. At least give it a chance.
Which they've not wanted to do so far.
Very few. A few have, and a few have gotten results. I might mention, of course, Professor Ramon Sanchez, who gave it a try, and he got some excellent results. He's another one of those brilliant people I was talking about, creative.
He found out how to extract energy from a distance.
That's right. He actually did the cross beams experiment, and it did work. There are others. I don't mean to say that I've, by any means named all the people. I've just named a few that I've personally worked with. And those people, and many others like them throughout the country, that are doing these unorthodox experiments, and particularly the ones that are doing what we very strongly pointed out here, what John and I have pointed out, are getting results. Now, the problem we all have is that we're still back, figuratively speaking, in this new stuff, we're back very similar stages to where they were in electromagnetics when they were still rubbing glass rods with cat fur trying to work out electromagnetism. The only way we're ever going to get this new science born is for all the sharp young graduate students and all these universities to start doing these kinds of experiments. There's 100 Nobel Prizes out there waiting for you, but it's not waiting for you by simply applying the other stuff that's already been worked out. Go find something new, and here's a whole new area. Have a go at it.
You won't find a Nobel Prize for yourself in your textbooks.
That's correct.
And I'm looking at two men who have put the textbooks aside because they have gone further beyond that. Are you ready to talk to the folks? Tom?
Oh, yes.
All right. Let me give the telephone numbers. If you have questions about free energy or a new kind of energy that you don't have to pay for, let's put it that way. We'll come Bedini and Steve Wirth in Dallas, Texas, on our conference line is Tom Bearden. Also in studio with me are some little devices that certainly do not operate in conjunction with the second law of thermodynamics or the law of conservation of energy. They're just destroying those two highly respected principles. But so be it.
But what we have to remember, Bill, is that's how nature works.
Nature works this way.
Nature doesn't have to pay any attention to any laws at all.
Yeah, it doesn't really care about the laws that man
makes
up with.
Man, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't have any new laws.
Actually, you know, we touched upon a term a little bit ago, gravity engineering.
Gravitational engineering. That's right, Bill. That's exactly what this is. It's gravitational engineering. And this world better get ready for it.
So you're engineering gravity to do work
for
you.
If our planet spins day in and day out, then there's no reason why we can't tap the spin of the planet, generate all the energy we want, and live like people are supposed to live. We won't have to look at gray skies anymore.
You have a device that turns counterclockwise here in the northern hemisphere and just produces energy like it was going out of style. Right. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you have to turn it the other way.
I would imagine it would want to go counterclockwise.
And so you're engineering gravity. You're creating electricity for it. Okay, let's go to our callers and see what's on their mind. Who's our first one here, Terry? All right, Craig, you're on.
Am I really? All right.
You're on.
You're actually coming in good and clear tonight.
Craig, you're up at where? Malpitas or up there someplace?
No, in Mid Pines.
Okay.
Anyways,
I'm glad to have you aboard, and I know it's a strain for you to try to get us up there, but we're glad to have you.
Well, the reception's good tonight. Let's see. Okay, I'll kind of reverse the order of my questions.
We have our energy devices working on the transmitter here.
Maybe. John, you were just about to describe the operation of your pendulum device. I am really totally unclear from the previous description as to how it taps into the energy field. Can you elaborate on that, Sim?
Yes, I can. I have been making chart recordings. You're familiar with that, right?
Specifically, what do you mean?
Chart recordings, like you would chart record earthquakes.
Oh, sure.
Okay. I have been noting that at certain times of the night that the pendulum picks up in momentum. And by that pendulum picking up in momentum, I'm gaining energy without putting any energy into the system.
Okay.
Now, I am describing to you a pendulum, which is a monopole motor in the center.
Before you go further, when you say monopole motor...
One pole, Craig. One pole, a north pole.
That's one thing that didn't make sense.
No complete circuit path, Craig. If you're going to gain any energy, you cannot have a complete circuit path.
Where would a regular old person come across a monopole magnet?
Craig?
Yes.
It's the way you place the magnet in the circuit.
Is it a conventional magnet?
One pole of a magnet. Yes, it is. It's a samarium cobalt magnet.
Okay.
I am only using one pole of the magnet, the north pole.
So it is a dipole magnet, but it's being used...
as a monopole.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Now, I am describing to you, Craig, a monopole motor running a conventional generator. The conventional generator makes up the same magnetic circuits that you are familiar with in the textbook. So what we have here is a monopole motor driving a pendulum effect. Certain times of the night, it will pick up because of the Earth's rotation, because it's not what is known as a planetarium pendulum that changes the arc as the Earth spins. You follow me?
Yes.
So what we want to do is pick up the momentum in the middle of the night. We are talking about an item which generates pulse currents. We're not necessarily looking for a constant output, Craig. We're looking for something that goes past the generator poles, produces amperes in a pulse. And that we are sending back to the battery by driving the monopole motor with very little input.
Now, where is the monopole motor in relation to the pendulum?
Right in the center. As the North Pole passes the trigger circuitry that's on this monopole motor, it produces a push, which keeps this pendulum rocking, no matter what. And then, through conventional means, which is in the textbook, we want to gather the energy by the swing of the pendulum. Now, it is also possible to put a sprag gear or pump water all day long with this pendulum the same way that an oil well pumps.
You're just extracting the energy in electrical form.
That's right. I am not wasting one bit of energy. I'm returning it back to the system.
So what is essentially the difference you're saying is in the design of the pendulum itself?
Craig, I want you to get... In fact, I want everybody to get a piece of paper and a pencil out there. And I want you to draw a normal pendulum. And underneath that pendulum, right in the center, I want you to put a magnetic coil of some type. And we'll call that the motor. On the opposite ends of the motor, right and left, as you face the pendulum, I want you to put two generation coils. I want the monopole to go back and forth between center, right and left, and as it goes between center, right and left, it generates a pulse in current output. I want you to return that back to the battery. So you can see that the motor's off as it generates. You're only using that motor for a little bitty push. It's the same as an oscillatory action in a Tesla coil. He was very specific when he said, vibrate the thing. Make it oscillate. The faster you make it oscillate, the more energy you will get. Is that clear?
Clear enough as far as you've gone. What I don't understand then is you were saying if you were to use it in a different application, where would the monopole motor fit in?
Craig, I want you to block out everything in your mind that you've ever been taught.
Okay.
All right, I want you to put the books down. I want you to forget about what you've been taught. What I want to do is open your mind up to think about how we can engineer a gravitational system to do the work for us. And we're going to do that with one of the simplest things, and that's a pendulum. Now, it's like a 500-pound weight on a swing, Craig. And behind that's a little child, and he's giving it a little tap. Sooner or later, it's going to go over the top, isn't it?
Perhaps.
Try it in the park sometime. That's all this motor is used for, is to give it a little tap every once in a while when the pendulum thinks that it's going to run down.
Okay.
Now, figure out in your mind a triggering circuit using a monopole. Or one pole of one magnet. Now, how would you do that, Craig?
Why don't you just go on? I'm not sure where you're trying to take it.
Craig, I am trying to get you to put down the book for a moment. I want everybody to put down the book. It's not in the books. I want you to open your mind and really think for a moment. Your wildest imagination. I'm going to take you on a ride right now. I'm going to put you on the swing set, Craig. And I'm going to get a little three-year-old to give you a tap every once in a while you're swinging away. Sooner or later, that little three-year-old is going to get you at 90-degree angle and you're going to fall off the swing, aren't you?
Well, if that's the crux of your argument, I don't know if I agree with that.
What, Craig, I'm trying to...
looking at it, Craig. It's just sitting here working.
Craig, I am trying to get you to use the part of your mind that you've never used before.
Well, tell me something. Tell me where I'm going wrong here. Using your analogy of a three-year-old pushing someone in a swing, as the person goes up, the gravity vector increases, okay, and it's very difficult to get someone up to the 90-degree angle.
It becomes
increasingly difficult to get someone further up.
Craig.
Right.
If it was at the right time, and the swing was oriented exactly right, the Earth would help you. It would add a little bit of energy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if you could set it up right.
Okay. I am using orthodox laws right now. The pendulum shows us the rotation of the Earth, right? So why not use the rotation of the Earth to aid us in getting energy?
Okay, so how are you setting up the pendulum differently to take advantage of that?
A normal pendulum, Craig. A normal pendulum, except that I have aided that pendulum by what I call a monopole motor, which gives that magnetic pole a little push every time the pendulum passes it. Now, I am taking advantage as that monopole crosses the two inductance coils on either side as a generator. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
I want you to send that back to the battery in a pulse.
Right. That's where you're pulling the energy out, sure.
That's right. So for 1.4 watts input, I could wind any coil I wanted for the output, never losing any energy, Craig. You see, I'm going to take advantage of what this big planet that we sit on does for us. And it spins. So why not use it?
It's a big dynamo, isn't it?
That's right. It's just waiting. And what really gets me hot under the collar, Bill, is what our science has taught us. They haven't shown us anything in 100 years. They have absolutely suppressed everything that could aid the people. Now, we could pump hundreds of gallons of water, Craig, for that little 1.4 watts and take advantage of the Earth, at the same time recharging the batteries that are running this pendulum. Now, if somebody makes a great big huge one, a typical example of that pendulum is in Joe Newman's motor. Okay, how does it keep the dry cell batteries charged? Very simply, Craig, a spike. You know what a spike is?
Sure.
The spike is very important in gravitational engineering. And it only finds itself releasing its energy if the item that it's going back to is nonlinear. Do you follow that? What happens, Craig, what happens in a computer if I take an electrostatic gun and walk up to the computer? Doesn't it blow out?
Okay.
Fine.
Yes.
But that tells you something. That tells you, if you really observe that, that little spike is very potent in a non-linear arrangement.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
And to take advantage of that spike, you have to have a non-linear arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
That is why I want you to get your paper and pencil out. I want you to listen to what I'm saying, and I want you to use your imagination for, never mind what you've been taught. That may not be correct someday. I want you to use your mind in engineering gravitational equipment that we can use.
And with that, Craig, we're going to have to go to some of the other callers. Unless you have one last question, do you want to pop the
door? I want to ask Tom Bearden something. He had mentioned that there are people who are doing experiments with scalar energy. he named one. I couldn't. That was one point where I couldn't hear clearly. I don't know if there's any others he could name. I wonder if he would be kind enough to name them and say where they're working and if they've had any papers that have actually been published.
I just named some of the people, Craig, that I've worked with myself personally. I didn't, you know, intend to say that I was naming everybody
sure.
by any means. I named, of course, John Bedini. And everybody has a pretty good idea of the various devices and free energy devices he's built. He's built also a pretty doggone good scalar detector. And by the way, scalar electromagnetics is electrogravitation. I named Frank Golden. I worked with him for quite a few years. Frank has done some rather fundamental things. Only recently,